Reopening Florida, a look at COVID's impact on farms and farmers, and playing sports in empty stadiums. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Floridians want to get back to work, but some public officials are hesitant. Today, we're talking with Democratic Representative Debbie McCarcel Powell, and we want to hear from you. Share your questions. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Also, farmers are struggling to get their product to market. Farm workers, many undocumented, are lacking necessary protective gear. Today, a look at life in the farms of Florida. Finally,
it's going to be like you doing your fantasy football draft in your basement, except these are the highest stakes. The Dolphins have been planning for this moment for a year and a half.
There's one sport that fans can get excited about. The NFL is holding its draft this week. But can we still expect a season? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. So when should Florida reopen? I mean, that's the question on the minds of millions of Floridians awaiting unemployment checks, hoping to get back to work. It's a tightrope policymakers and public health officials are walking as the pressure of an economic shutdown meets with the realities of a pandemic. Now, as of this morning, more than 27,000 cases were reported in Florida. Democratic Congresswoman Debbie McCarcel Powell is urging tremendous caution in the reopening of South Florida, especially. But when's the right time? And if you're waiting for unemployment benefits, when is your help coming? Give us a call, 800-743-9576. Again, that's 800-743-9576. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. What's your question? What's your thought about how to reopen Florida, especially South Florida? How do we get things going? Well, joining me now is the Congresswoman. Congresswoman, thank you so much for the time today. I appreciate it.
Hi, Luis. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the issue of testing. There are more sites now across South Florida, and there's also home testing programs here in Miami-Dade County. But based on your conversations with public health experts, how are we doing when it comes to testing, and when can we get more testing involved?
So nationally, what we have seen is that we are testing in the United States about 146,000 people daily, and we need to really triple that number and have between 500,000 to 700,000 people in the country if we want to start opening back the economy by, say, you know, mid to late May. One of the issues that we have seen also with these tests is that not only do we not have massive community testing here in our area, and I can tell you that in Monroe County, they have hardly any tests at all. I get calls on a daily basis from constituents, but also from some of our healthcare providers that they're really asking me for help because they are not receiving the test kits that they need. But we have seen that many of the tests that we have been using are giving false positives or false negatives. And when you hear about the antibody test, which people are discussing right now in order to start reopening the economy, we don't have any antibody testing right now that we think is validated that will be giving us the results, accurate results. So we need to be very, very careful because at this point, like you just reported, I was listening to the segment right before I got on the call. And we don't have that immunity built in our communities. And we haven't seen that expansive testing capacity, which is what I've been calling for and other congressional colleagues as well.
So you're saying we have to triple our testing. So what do we have to do to increase it? Why haven't we?
That's a great question, Luis. I was just on a call with the FEMA directors managing now the distribution of this testing. And that's the question that not only do I have here locally, but we had senators on the call from all over the United States asking what is the holdup with getting these tests distributed. And one of the problems that we've had is that we've been competing against each other to get the right equipment for these tests. That's one. And the president has not invoked the National Defense Production Act. Now, apparently this week he did call to for the Department of Defense to begin that process. We have at this moment in this country, many companies across the nation that are ready to start producing the test swabs that you keep hearing about and other reagents. We are right now competing globally to get these supplies from China. So that's been one of the biggest hurdles to get those tests to the communities that need it the most. But why are we waiting for supplies from China? We know that we can't rely on that country. We know that there are issues with the authoritarian regime that we've seen in China. Why are we not mass producing those supplies here in the United States?
Now, the president has invoked the Defense Production Act for certain needed medical supplies, but you're referring specifically to test production.
To the test swabs. You know, those swabs, that's part of the problem, that we don't have enough swabs to conduct the tests. Now, the reagents, apparently, we do need to get those reagents from different countries, and one of them being China. But I know that here we can start producing, mass producing those swabs that we need.
You know, you talk to health officials regularly. What do they tell you about the official count? I mean, I just reported it's in the 27,000 range now. But do we believe that it's a lot larger than that?
Well, look, here's the problem. We are right now in my area. I was talking to one of the testing sites, and they were testing between 200 and 300 people a day. And a lot of the tests that they're using are from commercial labs, private commercial labs. It's taking anywhere between 7 and 10 days for people to get their test results. I get messages from different constituents saying, I tested a week ago. Can you please help me expedite the results? People are very nervous and anxious, and appropriately so, waiting for those results. So the numbers that you're seeing today that are reported in the Florida Department of Health don't necessarily include the numbers of infections that we have in the community currently, because so many people are waiting for those test results. So that's an issue that we're dealing with. Also, there's still a lack of information on how the virus works, Luis. I've had numerous conference calls with different groups in my area, and people still don't understand how the virus works. That for me is alarming. That's something that I've been working with different community leaders to make sure that information is disseminated, especially to our low-income areas and communities of color, which have been disproportionately impacted by this disease, so that they know that it's a highly contagious virus that can be lethal, that people with pre-existing conditions and people older than 65 years old have a higher likelihood of getting the disease and getting more affected by the disease, that there are no vaccines and no treatments.
Again, I'm talking with Democratic Representative Debbie McCarsel-Powell, and again, her region, she carries a lot of Homestead in the Florida Keys. If you have a question for the congresswoman about coronavirus, unemployment benefits, reopening our economy, how should we do that, testing, any of these, give us a call, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. By the way, also, if she is your congresswoman, what about testing in your area? Let us know what that's like if you're able to have access to testing. Congresswoman, considering we don't have a clear count yet, again, of how we were talking about, how do you feel about the idea of reopening parts of South Florida? The Mayor Carlos Jimenez, by the way, who is also running against you, just to mention, other mayors in the area have been talking about this, talking about reopening parks, talking about reopening beaches, talking about trying to get the economy going back up again. What are your thoughts about getting this open up at least a little bit right now?
Yeah. So, you know, as we were just discussing, we are seeing an increase in cases of COVID-19 here locally. And I think that it's premature for the governor or any local executive to start discussing opening public spaces, parks, beaches, loosening guidelines. I know, believe me, I hear it all the time from my family, from my friends. We all want to return to our pre-coronavirus lives. But I think that at this point, easing those restrictions are really putting at risk the health of our community, but it also can put more weight on our public health infrastructure. It can really pose a threat to our public health infrastructure. Right now, what we've seen is that social distancing, staying at home, has helped us contain the spread of the virus. That curve initially was at a much higher rate. It was predicting many more hospitalizations. We've been able to lower the rate of hospitalizations. We have not lowered the rate of infections yet. We have not reached that peak. I think that we need to reach the peak, see at least a couple of weeks where we can see that we have data showing that the amount of cases is of contagious disease is decreasing. The number of hospitalizations is also decreasing, including the number of deaths. We just saw overnight in Miami-Dade County between 7 to 8 deaths being reported. And these are people from all ages, I have to say. I mean, a few of the deaths that I've been seeing are adults that are healthy between the ages of 45 and 55.
And you, but here, so here's now the pushback is, it's not that people are getting antsy about wanting to go outside or wanting to go out to a club or go to a bar or anything like that. It's people are antsy because they got to get back to work and they got to put food on the table. And now what we're seeing nationally is that tension. Okay, there's a risk, there's a danger, but we got to survive. And so now there's a tug of war in between these two sides.
You know, and I don't think that it should be a discussion between the health of our community and our economic health. I think that they're interconnected. And the problem is that if you open too early, if you start opening spaces and you see a high rate of infection right away, it's going to do greater damage to the economy. So one of the interesting points that I would like to bring up is that we have a failing unemployment system in the state of Florida. We have seen over 1 million people that have filed for unemployment benefits, and only about 40,000 of them have been processed. The governor and other local elected officials need to figure out a way to get that money into the pockets of the people that need it the most. We passed this package at the end of March, and they anticipated a surge of applications. And I think it's easier for the governor to say, you know what, we need to start reopening the economy because there's this pressure for him to perform. We need that money to be distributed right away. And at the same time, in Congress, what we are doing right now is passing an interim package, an interim emergency funding package to help American workers and businesses stay afloat. I know that right now there are thousands of people in my area that are facing food insecurity. I know that many people don't know how they're going to pay the rent in the 1st of May. We are doing everything in Congress to provide that relief, but reopening right now too quickly, what we will see is a resurgence of cases for COVID-19, and then it'll take longer to get back to any sense of normality for our economy and for our community.
We're talking with Democratic Representative Debbie McCarsel-Powell. If you have a question right now, give us a call, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Before we get to the phones, Congresswoman, so the state is dealing with its issue. We will talk with state officials about that. They have to fix that. But looking at the federal government, so if we have to go longer without being able to pay our bills, without being able to pay our rent, mortgage, et cetera, having that issue with getting food, getting people back to work, is the federal government ready to basically just say, all right, you know what, we're just going to keep paying you to keep you solvent until this is resolved?
Well, no, I mean, this is not going to be something. I'm not saying let's never open the economy again, Luis. Let me make something very clear. I think that we need to do it based on science, data, numbers, making sure that we have all the systems in place to have a public health infrastructure supported so that we can start testing, have widespread testing, contact tracing. So if you have those people that test positive, you immediately contact the people that they were in contact with so that we can quarantine them so that slowly you can start bringing people back to work.
So we've heard all that. When can we start to do that, though? Yeah, we know that, but okay. Can we start doing that?
No. It's a very important point. And I can tell you that in this emergency funding bill, we have included $25 billion to expand testing. And right now, we're still negotiating the parameters on how we're going to distribute that funding, because we need to make sure that if we're passing an additional $25 billion to extend testing capacity, we have to make sure that those test kits go to the community, especially those hotspots. South Florida is a hotspot in the state of Florida. The three counties combined account for half of the cases here in the entire state. So we need to see those test kits, and there has to be a national coordinated effort. And we have a plan for that in Congress. I have partnered with my colleague, Donna Shalala, and other members of Congress with the Reopen America Act. And that's based on science and numbers. And that's we have a plan in place so that we can slowly reopen the economy, but in a way that's not going to harm the health of Floridians.
And I want to ask you about that plan. Let me go to the phones. I want to start with Mike in Aventura. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hi. Oh, my gosh. First-time caller, long-time listener. Okay. There were so many questions. I'm a blind person. And my question is, you talk about social distance. If you're totally blind, how do you know what social distance is? You've never dealt with that situation. And there were other things that this whole thing hasn't dealt with concerning with the blind or disabled.
Well, Mike, let me ask you this. How have you been doing it?
Well, number one, what I've been doing is, unfortunately, I haven't been able to go out. But when I did, I would just kind of walk along with my cane.
I see. All right. Any other question though you have for the Congresswoman?
Yeah. When they open up the bill, when they open up everything, will people be allowed to like go to parks and go swimming or do different things like that?
Okay. Mike, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, Luis. And here's the issue that I have, and that's why I err on the side of caution here and being extra careful when you start opening public spaces. People are getting mixed signals. You know, I read a little bit of the plan to reopen some of the public parks here in Miami-Dade County. You know, if you're jogging, you're not required to wear a mask, but if you're walking, you need to wear a mask. And it's confusing because do you spread the virus when you're walking or when you're jogging? I mean, people are asking, what if I don't have a basketball to bring to the park? And you're saying that I can go to the park, but I need to have a basketball and then you can play. I mean, it's sending mixed messages. People need a clear directive. Even with a stay-at-home order that we've seen here in the county, there's a lot of activity and cases continue to go up. So I think that at this point, after asking so many people to make the sacrifice, so many people that have lost their jobs because they have been responsible and they have stayed at home, to all of a sudden lift those restrictions and people start relaxing and then you see a resurgence of cases. Again, what we're going to see is it's going to be a longer time until we start recovering economically.
All right. You know, before I go back to the phones, besides opening up parks and beaches, what about opening up businesses? Because, again, it's about getting people back to work. What do you envision those first businesses, industries that could get going again?
Yeah, so I actually was speaking with one of the business owners here locally, and they have a plan of slowly getting a few employees, maybe having shifts where they would go twice a week, and so that they don't have full capacity at the beginning. They would all have hand sanitizers at their stations. They would have to wipe down the entire station and sanitize the office. I mean, you have to really follow the guidelines that the CDC has provided. So it depends on the size of the business. You know, we've seen how the businesses in Iowa and Kansas and those meatpacking factories have had high rates of infection because the employees have to work side by side. So it's a little bit more difficult to follow those guidelines. So it depends on the business that you're conducting.
I'm going to go to the phones. I'm going to go to Laz in Homestead. Laz, welcome to the program.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you?
Good. What's going on?
A quick question. I work directly across the street from a testing site in Homestead. They usually open up about 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. There's a long line of cars, but they wind down about 12:30, 1 o'clock. Is it the testing sites, you know, just running a half day, or are we running out of tests, out of people to test? That's my question, basically, because I'm always perplexed that, you know, testing, but 4 hours, 3.5 hours, you can't do it on the test.
Yeah. So some of the testing sites that I have seen that I've spoken to, they only have a certain amount of time where they're conducting tests. That could be the case in the one in Homestead. And I believe you're talking about CHI, who's conducting tests there. And I have to say, I'm very proud of CHI. They were the first drive-through testing site in the entire Miami-Dade County and in the South Dade area. But the reality also is that we don't have enough tests to be conducting, you know, an indefinite number of tests at all the testing sites. That's part of the issue.
All right. One more question. We're only testing people with symptoms and I believe there's another criteria, but asymptomatic people, when eventually, hopefully, we start testing everybody.
Yes. Yeah, so, right. Yeah, sorry.
Go ahead,
how are we going to be able to get enough tests? If we don't have enough tests now to test a small portion of the society, how are we going to test everybody?
Yeah, so right now, just to comment on that, the criteria for testing, I think, remains too strict, far too strict to really seriously consider reopening our economy here in South Florida. We need to make sure that we can triple the amount of tests, which I just mentioned, so that we can reopen in a safe manner. And what I had mentioned earlier is that we need to invoke that Defense Production Act so that we can start manufacturing the supplies for these tests and working closely with these commercial labs. There's no national coordination with the distribution and the supply chain of the test kits. We don't know. We have been asking FEMA now for over a week to give us the data on how many tests have been distributed to where. We need to understand those numbers. And we just had a call this morning where I asked FEMA, what data are you using so that you can increase capacity, not just for testing, but for PPE equipment? And they don't have the data. The response that I got from FEMA is we're filling in the gaps. We should not be conducting ourselves in that manner. We're the United States of America. We have the Defense Production Act that the president can invoke and really start massive manufacturing for PPE, for test swabs, for other supplies that are needed for our healthcare workforce. And those are the things that in Congress we are pushing for right now.
Let me get one more call, and I'm going to go to Raul in West Palm Beach. Raul, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I don't have a specific question. I just want to kind of reiterate what the Congresswoman has been saying about staying at home. I'm a healthcare provider. I work in a testing site, and again, staying at home, especially those people who have been tested positive. I know some cases where people who have been tested positive are still going outside of their homes. They're still trying to make appointments with the doctors to come to the office. None of our work is going to be successful if people are not staying at home. So again, I just want to reiterate that the importance of staying at home, make sure that those people are not going outside. And definitely, you know, the testing site that I work at, to kind of answer the question of one of our previous callers, we do have a full day, but sometimes they only schedule patients until 12, so we close the site at 12:30. But again, it's also a lack of testing that we don't have that many testing in our site.
Raul, thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it. Congresswoman, I'll finish with this interesting point that he makes. I mean, there are just folks who... they're not going to follow the guidelines. They're not going to go along with what everybody else is trying to do to protect the community. Do we have to be tighter on our restrictions?
Look, I think that I speak for everyone that we are all looking forward to that point where we can get back to normal here in South Florida, but we need to do it cautiously. And what we need to do at this point is just wait until we hit that peak, which we're still unclear as to when that's going to be. Some models showed it to be May 3rd, May 4th. Then we need to make sure that we have consistent data showing that we have a lower number of cases for at least 2 weeks after we've reached that peak. And the rate of infection has to be one or below, and we haven't seen that yet. And in the meantime, what I do want to stress is that what we have seen is that staying at home, social distancing, all those guidelines have helped us contain that curve. I ask for patience. We are going to be passing that bill this week that will add $25 billion for more tests nationally and hopefully here in South Florida where we have that hotspot so that we can spread the amount of tests that we see in the community. And slowly, once we get through that curve and we have the test, the contact tracing that we're going to need, and we see that rate of infection going down, we will slowly be able to open up the economy.
We've been talking with Democratic Representative Debbie McCarthy-Powell. Congresswoman, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you. Thank you, Luis.
All right. Still to come, it's harvest season in South Florida. We're going to take a look at how the pandemic is affecting farmers and farm workers. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers is demanding that the state of Florida and Governor Ron DeSantis open a field hospital in the rural farms in the southwest part of the state. Farm workers there work in close quarters, making it extremely challenging to comply with social distancing guidelines. Advocates fear that if the virus strikes, coronavirus cases could spread and it could impact the food supply chain nationwide. Joining us now is Gerardo Reyes Chavez, one of the leaders of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Mr. Chavez, thank you so much for the time.
No, on the contrary, thank you for inviting us.
So Florida farmers continue to work. They are considered essential workers. What's one of the biggest challenges right now that you and other farm workers are facing in this pandemic?
Well, as you were mentioning, we are a workforce that lives in a reality in which it is impossible to be able to observe social distancing. You know, all of those recommendations coming from the CDC and the Department of Health, the World Health Organization, means nothing when you as a worker live in a context in which, in order to save money because you are poor, you live with 10 to 12 people on a mobile home. That's where all the problem begins, you know, in terms of overcrowded conditions that makes it impossible for social distancing. And then you wake up, go to work, and are taken to different companies in repurposed school buses. So there's no space there to distance yourself from other people. Along with the fact that personal protective equipment has not been provided by the state in any like general way, there's been some efforts with some representatives from the emergency management to try to coordinate and get some masks, and they have been already distributed, but besides that, there is no possibility to be able to protect the workers from exposure, let alone to be able to respond, because there's no plan when this hits and gets a hold of our community. There is not going to be any meaningful response ready, because they have not been paying attention to this as they should.
You know, just talking with the Congresswoman about testing, and I'm wondering, do any of the farm workers have access to testing? Is there a testing site anywhere near you?
Testing was limited, and it was non-existent even in our community for weeks. We were asking for that as one of the asks that we sent, included in the letter to Governor Ron DeSantis. But that only happened about, I think the first tests took place at the end of the month, I think the 31st of this past month. And since then, it's been just really sporadic. I think that by the end of last week, there were 85 tests applied only in the entire community.
And have there been any positive tests come back?
Up to date, and I don't know what the count of tests applied up to date is, but the counting of people testing positive for COVID-19, it's 24 as of this morning. So when you think about the fact that we have such a high ratio, you know, 85, let's say that 100 tests or a little bit over 100 tests, and here I'm assuming, where deployed in that community, that doesn't really reflect the reality, you know? There's no ability for the health system to know how many people are infected already in our community because there hasn't been any meaningful testing going on around our community.
And that's as simple as it gets,
you know?
And with the people who've tested positive, do they get self-quarantined, or are they still, because as you said, living conditions within the community for a lot of these workers, you've got a lot of people living in a small little space together. But what's happened to those folks who tested positive?
The information, it's not available in terms of what the plan has been or is in regards to the Department of Health. So we have not heard any kind of information in regards to what type of follow-up is being done here.
Do you know anybody? Do you know any of the workers who have it?
I don't.
Okay.
Personally, I don't. It's possible that people that we know have it already, but they won't talk about it. Because here's the thing. You know, when you talk about what is that follow-up, how can people isolate, there is no way in which people can, effectively isolate themselves. You live with 10 to 12 other people. Sometimes you don't even know these people. Who's going to be taking care of you? And where are you going to isolate if you live with three or four other guys?
Right.
Or if you live with your family, there's sometimes two, three families. How are you supposed to isolate to protect your loved ones from contagion? You can't. So that's why we were asking in the letter also to the governor to provide the ability for people to isolate once they have been tested positive
and
to avoid contagion in the entire crew, because that's when that's what's going to happen ultimately.
I wanted to touch on what you asked of the governor, because one of the other things you're asking for is a field hospital. Specifically, what is it you need?
Well, what we need, it's to be able to respond, not to just be focusing on the mitigation aspect of it, and really poorly, actually, if you ask my opinion. You cannot mitigate a pandemic like this one by simply expecting that somehow miraculously people are not going to get infected, because that has been the approach. You know, we have cautionary tales already happening in other places related to food. If you think about what happened just a few days ago in Smithville, where it started in April 13, I think, with a report of 230 workers in this pork meatpacking facility in South Dakota. When you think about the fact that there were 230 workers that tested positive on April the 13th, and then 2 days later, I think it went up to 545 cases confirmed, either by people in the plant that whose tests were just coming back,
yeah,
and tested positive. I think it was 545 with the people that tested positive in the community that had connection with the workers who were already infected. So they were infecting their families in the same way that people will be infecting their families here.
Yeah,
and there's no testing, so there's no way to know the depth of the hold the COVID-19 already has in communities like ours.
I want to cut in. I apologize. I want to end on this note with you. Is one, are you hearing anything from the state, but also from the farms, your employers? What are they doing to help you right now?
There are efforts taking place where there's a farm, there's a company that's working with us due to the previous collaborations that have been taking place in the implementation of the Fair Food Program, which is basically an agreement with growers, with some corporations that have signed on to protect the human rights of workers. So in those bases, within that partnership, there's been efforts by some companies to provide more space for workers by bringing in more buses that belong to the companies to transport people and try to keep them a little bit more separated.
Yes.
You know, there are efforts to also dedicate some spaces in the housing that belongs to them. They offer to H2A workers in the case of the contagion taking place and severe symptoms showing up, so that they can isolate people. But that's a minimum. That's the most minimum of things that we should be doing. And there are companies that are doing what they can, but that's also something that it's happening only in a small, really small fraction. What we need is the state. We need the government to give the order to build a field hospital in our community so that when people start to show severe symptoms, they have somewhere to go and be treated, because the closest hospital is about 40 minutes away.
Right.
And we don't have transportation.
All right. I have to end it there. Gerardo Reyes Chavez, again, with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Mr. Chavez, thank you so much for sharing with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for inviting us, and I hope that people take action.
Thank you again. So talking with farm workers, we have to look at farms as well here in South Florida and how they're shifting their operations. I mean, some are selling in bulk. Others have opened up online shops. I want to talk now with John Mills. He's the president of Renland Community Farm and Market in Homestead. Mr. Mills, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. How are you?
You know, Mr. Mills, I'm doing okay. I hope you're hanging in there. Give me a sense of just the ag industry in general and what this pandemic has done.
Well, as you commented at the start there, a lot of us farmers are shifting the mode of distributing our products to try and move it. Large quantities were stopped in shipment right at the last minute as New York and the other cities started stopping shipments. So I'm a relatively small farmer here. I run 140 acres plus a 22-acre organic farm for the Homeless Trust of Miami. And we immediately shifted our operations to instead of having a market where people come in and shop through what we have available, we started a drive-thru. And they take their orders. They can place them now online or just drive up, give us an order, stay in their vehicle. It's all boxed up by individuals wearing masks and gloves. And then they tap the vehicle after they've paid and they move on.
Have you had to make any big changes in the sort of food that you're producing?
Well, we're producing pretty much the same products. It's towards the end of the produce production here in South Florida. So we still have beans, squash, tomatoes, a few other items that are still available. So we're starting to actually backhaul from points north as this bow wave of difficulty of shipping moves north. We'll be actually flowing product back south to keep an adopt-a-box program that we've started with a 20-pound box of mixed fruit and vegetables that will go out to each family that come through our Saturday distribution points.
And as you said, you know, you provide for you know, the those in need in the community. I'd imagine that the need has grown quite a bit.
Tremendously, yeah. We're trying to do a kind of a different approach than a lot of the nonprofits have been taking donations and then trying to get that distributed. We're actually collecting a donation that is $25 a box. We go out and buy the best of quality of the product, running it through Grove Services, Unity Services. We'll then take it through a certified food safety facility, pack it clearly under the guidelines, the strictest guidelines for the virus protection, and then we distribute it out free to the populace in various locations.
As you said, as you said, that we're coming up to the end of much of the harvest for South Florida. What do you think is going to happen? You know, I mean, we can get through the summer, but when we start up the harvest season again, if we're still under these kind of conditions, how do you envision, what do you envision happening to the ag industry in general?
Well, it's even sooner than the next planting of the row crops. Within 2 to 3 weeks, we'll have fruit crops coming off that will hit the same problems of distribution. So, we envision this kind of innovative way of doing distribution and paying the farmers for their product and then distributing it versus just looking for a donation as a way to keep the farming alive. The 140 acres that I run privately is mostly tree crop, and none of that has come off. So we're starting at zero income for a lot of the fruit farmers that we need to do it. Similar distribution like this, and try and basically set the example for use of federal funds. I mean, we're getting out $20,000 to $30,000 worth of product a week is what we can collect in donations, but it really is much bigger than that. We could crank that up through packing houses here. There's many idle now to $750,000. Dollars a week if we were really turned it on. It's just a matter of getting the funds flow out of the appropriations.
Yeah. Well, you know what? We're going to see how this all plays out, and hopefully, the ag industry is an important part of Florida's economy, that it's going to be able to survive as well. Mr. Mills, I really appreciate the time. Thank you so much. Definitely. John Mills, again, president of Redland Community Farm and Market in Homestead. We'll have more information, by the way, about that program and what he was talking about here on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, this Thursday will be an NFL draft unlike any other. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. You know, traditionally, this is that time of year. We're in the NBA playoffs, the NHL playoffs. We're sort of caring about the Marlins, at least for now anyway. Sports, though, like everything else, has had to be put on hold. But there's one key exception starting on Thursday. Oh, I love that sound. I miss it. Team owners from around the NFL are going to be listening closely for that sound to begin their pick in this year's NFL draft. As the Miami Dolphins beat reporter Adam Beasley explained to me last week, this year, it's going to be weird.
Football wasn't touched because it's not till the fall. Granted, they still have to have, you know, spring practices, and then there's the training camp. Has there been talk about how players are supposed to be able to have those kind of meetings and stay in shape and get ready for a season if we're not allowed to have anything?
There won't be any team able to practice for a long while, because the NFL's rule is if one facility is shut down by the state or city, all 32 facilities are going to be shut down. So there are going to be a lot of online learning right now, kind of like kids around America. They're going to be players going to be sitting in front of their computers, learning the playbook virtually. And there will also be some remote physical training. The strength coach will take the players through workouts, kind of like you see your grandma do sweating to the oldies. They're going to be doing that, push-ups, sit-ups, curls, things like that. Every team is allowed to send each player $1,500 worth of gear, equipment, kettlebells, mats, dumbbells, the equipment they're going to need to stay in shape. It's not going to be the same, obviously, as being in there in a world-class weight room, but it's not like these guys are going to just let themselves go. They're professional athletes. The teams are going to be on top of them to work out.
You know, there have been people who've said that they'd be surprised if there would even be a football season. We don't know what's going to happen and how long this will last, but have you heard anything from players or the team or anybody in the league about the possibility that the season could be canceled?
You'll be shocked to hear this, but the NFL and the Players Union aren't exactly on the same page when it comes to this. They're never on the same page, it seems, but the NFL is planning as if the season is going to start in early September. The Players Union is like, whoa, pump the brakes here. We hope it's going to start then, but let's see how this thing develops. And there's a lot of unknowns right now. We just don't know what the disease is going to look like in 4 months when training camps will be revving up. I will say this, there's a way to play football. It might be under some draconian measures where players have to be away from their families, sequestered in North Dakota for 4 or 5 months. But there's so much at stake money-wise for both the league, the owners, and the players, everyone involved, to get this thing going. They're going to figure out a way to play football. Here's the flip side that no one's talking about, though. I think by September, we'll kind of have a handle on this. I mean, they're talking about lifting some lockdowns in the next few weeks. Maybe by June 1, we'll see some more movement. So by September, you'd think they'd be okay. Might not be in front of fans. It might be in front of empty stadiums, but football could happen. The broader issue no one's talking about is if this illness is cyclical, if it's seasonal, if it's going to come back in the winter, are they going to be able to finish the season? That's the great unknown.
So they have to consider possibly a shortened season, but also this, and this is all the other sports are considering, playing with no fans, which is just unimaginable. But I don't know, what are you hearing from players about the possibility that they might play in a stadium or they'll play in a field and nobody's watching? They'll watch on TV, but nobody's watching.
Yeah, I think they would be okay with that. I think what they'd have real problems with would be if they would be taken away from their families and sequestered for half a year. I think that would cause some real hardship, particularly because they'd be worried about their wives, kids, moms, dads, brothers, and sisters back home, and they can't be around to help them if there's a coronavirus instance in their family. So there's so many levels to this, but I will say this. This is a $60 billion industry. There is great, great incentive for all parties involved to figure out a way to play games. I think we're going to see football this fall. It just might look very different than anything we're used to.
So there's one thing that is happening, and that is the draft. And it's coming April 23rd through the 25th. They were going to hold this in Las Vegas, and my understanding is they were going all out. It was going to be extravagant, outrageous, right?
Yeah, it's pretty low on the list of grievances, but that ticket got eaten for me. I was supposed to fly out there for the week and cover the draft, and sadly, that, like everything else, has been shut down. But it was going to be over the top. It was going to be Caligula West. I mean, it was going to be really, really wild. And sadly, we're going to have to wait a year or two to see those plans come to fruition. There will be no mega draft like we're accustomed to. Hundreds of thousands of people in the streets. Of course, that would never happen. Nevada won't allow it in these times. What will happen is this. A studio show based out of Bristol, where ESPN is headquartered, and the commissioner will be announcing the picks in his basement, I believe, in Westchester County, New York. So we're going to have a draft. It's going to be a studio show. The teams are all going to be linked in through either Zoom or whatever the platform the NFL decides to use, video conferencing with both the league and other teams. It's going to be wild. It's going to be like you doing your fantasy football draft in your basement at 2 o'clock in the morning on the Thursday before the season starts, except these are the highest stakes. The Dolphins have been planning for this moment for a year and a half.
How are they preparing for the technological glitches that could come during a draft in a situation like this?
There will be redundancy upon redundancy upon redundancy. If, say, Chris Greer's internet goes out, he can call Brian Flores, and Brian Flores can call the league, or they can call the league directly. There's a lot of different ways to get that information in. And to be honest, the first round shouldn't be a problem. I think you get 10 minutes for each pick in the first round. That won't be a big deal, because if your internet dies, you can make workarounds pretty quickly. What the problem will be is on Saturday of the draft, when the picks are 3-5 minutes and they come out rapid fire, pick after pick. If Comcast is giving you some issues, if you're locked down, if you're frozen and you can't get in touch with the league, they're just going to skip you in the order.
All right, as you said, there's a lot at stake for the Dolphins here. They have a lot of picks in this draft. Remind us how many, and how did they get so many?
Yeah, they have 14 draft picks, including 3 in the first round. They have the most draft capital, and they've added the most draft capital to the 7 picks that the league gives each team anyway. They got all those picks by essentially punting on the 2019 season. It's so much fun if you're a Dolphins fan, because the draft is a time of hope. It's a time of looking to the future. It's a time of, do we finally get the franchise quarterback that's going to lead us out of the wilderness? The Dolphins are in position to do so. Now they just have to execute.
All right, you said it. Look, the elephant in the room. Let's just talk about the one guy we're all trying to get, the quarterback. And for a year and a half, all we've heard is there's this guy, Tua, in Alabama, and he's going to be our future. So, Adam, break the news right here, right now. Who are the Dolphins picking?
Oh, the drama, the pressure. I don't know for certain. No one aside from the people in that room know for certain right now. But I would say the odds are against them drafting Tua Tagovailoa because of the great uncertainty about his health. He underwent three surgeries in the last two seasons at Alabama, including that massive hip injury. Some people think he's going to have maybe need to get a hip replacement someday. Certainly arthritis is a concern. They think he'll be fine to play in 2020, but his long-term health is a big, big worry.
Oh, the suspense, Adam. You didn't even answer the question. That was the Miami Herald Dolphins beat reporter Adam Beasley. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, April 21st. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to be talking with Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez. If you have a question for the mayor, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. By the way, go to Facebook. I'll tell you exactly who the Dolphins are picking. I put it there. I'm Luis Hernandez. Stay safe. We'll talk to you tomorrow.